The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. MyAudiobooks.ai presents Musketaquid to the Junction, a landscape history of West Concord, Massachusetts, 1600s to 1970s. Prologue. Imagine a crisp autumn morning in 1978 along the banks of the Assabet River in Concord, Massachusetts. A young architect stands at the edge of an old mill pond, sketchpad in hand, gazing up at the weathered brick facade of the Damon Mill. The structure looms like a sentinel from another era, its tall windows reflecting the slow-moving water below. Nearby, a freight train rumbles past on tracks that slice through the village, its whistle echoing against the distant walls of the state prison. The architect pauses, tracing the lines where river, rail, and institution converge, wondering how this unassuming corner of New England became a crossroads of industry, incarceration, and quiet reinvention. This scene unfolds in West Concord, a village on the western edge of historic Concord, Massachusetts, a place long shadowed by its more famous eastern neighbor, with its Revolutionary War bridges and transcendentalist legacies. Yet here, in this basin of winding brooks and low meadows, a different story has taken root over centuries. It begins not with Minutemen or philosophers, but with the land itself, shaped by the Assabet River and its tributaries like Neshoba Brook and the slender Second Division Brook. These waters, once part of the indigenous region known as Musketaquid, meaning the place where the waters flow through the grasses, have drawn people for millennia, from Nipmuc and Massachusetts families who fished and farmed its fertile edges, to English settlers who harnessed its flow for mills and forges. Key figures emerge in this narrative, each tied to the landscape's transformation. Consider Calvin Carver Damon, the innovative mill owner who, in the 1830s, rebuilt a modest textile operation into a powerhouse producing Domet flannel, a clever cotton-wool blend that warmed generations. His brick mill, rising beside the river after a devastating fire, became a beacon of progress, employing hundreds and anchoring what locals called Factory Village. Then there's the Harrington family, whose sprawling estate near Neshoba Brook controlled vital crossings and fields. As they subdivided their lands in the late 19th century, Harrington Avenue sprang forth, knitting together homes for workers and weaving the social fabric of the growing community. Southward, the imposing presence of the Massachusetts State Reformatory, later the Massachusetts Correctional Institution at Concord, looms large. Its walls erected in 1878 on sandy uplands, drawing guards and staff whose steady paychecks sustained families amid the village's booms and busts. And along the overlooked Second Division Brook, the Musketaquid Sportsman Club, founded around the turn of the 20th century, carved out a niche for recreation, its members tending shooting grounds and fishing spots that preserved a sliver of wildness against encroaching suburbia. These elements highlight the essential context: West Concord's evolution from rural outpost to industrial junction and beyond, driven by water power, railroads, and institutional might. Musketaquid, with its seasonal weirs and managed meadows, set the stage for colonial dams and mills that reshaped rivers into engines of commerce. By the 1870s, the crossing of rail lines turned meadows into a hub, handling over 100 trains a day, earning the nickname The Junction, a label that lingered even after official maps decreed West Concord in 1928. The prison added layers of complexity, blending reformist ideals with economic stability, while brooks like Second Division served as subtle boundaries, channeling both water and community life. At the heart of this tale lies an intriguing paradox. How does a place defined by movement and confinement, by flowing rivers and iron bars, endure through cycles of prosperity and decline? What forces pulled Concord's gravity westward, forging a village distinct from the town's storied center, only to see it adapt anew in an age of highways and heritage? As the architect in that 1978 morning folds his sketchpad and walks toward the tracks, he senses the weight of these questions, the invisible threads connecting past to present.
Listeners joining this journey will uncover the hidden rhythms of geography and human ambition, gaining fresh eyes for a landscape where every bend in the brook and shadow of a mill whispers of resilience and reinvention. The story awaits just beyond the river's curve. 20th century town maps of Concord, Massachusetts show the western side of town almost like a hand spread open. The Assabet River runs through the center like a palm,
curving and looping as it goes. From the north, Neshoba Brook slides down through old mill sites and wetlands before meeting the river. To the south and west, a smaller thread, Second Division Brook, winds past backyards and thickets before it, too, finds its way toward larger water. Where these three watercourses narrow and cross roads and tracks, the village now called West Concord takes shape. Concord's historic town center sits a couple of miles to the east, clustered around its familiar green, church spires, and 18th-century houses. That older center grows up around town meeting, court sessions, and the slow traffic of carts on the road from Boston. West Concord, by contrast, begins as a landscape of fields and outlying commons. Over time, it hardens into a village of mills, yards, and sidings. One place talks first in the language of politics and memory. The other speaks in the language of payrolls, water wheels, and timetables. Even today, long after the age of steam has passed, that difference is audible in a single nickname. For generations, people in surrounding towns speak of West Concord simply as the Junction. The official name on road signs may change in the 20th century, but the old label lingers in conversation. It is a fossil of the period when tracks and trains dominate this corner of Concord. It recalls an era when more than 100 trains a day rumble through a village that once is only meadow and swamp. Reaching that world of whistles and signals takes time. The story here begins long before any English surveyor plants a stake or any railroad crew measures a grade. It begins in an older place name, Musketaquid. This is the word used by indigenous people for this region of grassy, river-laced lowland. In that word, and in the way Nipmuc and Massachusetts families use the land, lie the first clues. They help explain why this western part of Concord eventually becomes something separate from the town center. Musketaquid is not a town in the European sense. It is a well-watered region, often translated as the place where the waters flow through the grasses. Here, rivers spread out into broad, wet meadows. For thousands of years, long before recorded history, native people live within this basin. Archaeological work describes at least 10,000 years of habitation in the wider Concord area. It is a span of time that makes the centuries since English settlement feel almost brief. The geography that sustains those communities is generous, but not wild in the way early colonists imagine. The Assabet and Sudbury Rivers join to form the Concord River just east of the later town center. This creates a network of roughly 9 miles of navigable water. Side brooks, like Neshoba Brook and Second Division Brook, feed the main channels. Wet meadows line the rivers, while beaver dams back up smaller streams into ponds. Pine oak forests run across the uplands, broken by patches of denser hardwoods and shrub swamps. Nipmuc and Massachusetts families use this landscape in patterns that follow both season and topography. Local histories describe seasonal camps along the main rivers and the larger brooks, including sites close to the future West Concord. In spring, when fish move upstream, families gather at long-used fishing places. They build weirs in shallow brooks, weaving brush and stakes into low fences. These barriers guide fish into baskets or nets. Along Neshoba Brook and similar streams, those weirs make the seasonal fish runs reliable, turning timing and skill into steady food rather than a gamble. Agriculture enters this pattern well before any English plow arrives. Regional studies indicate that by roughly 1,000 years before European contact, people in Musketaquid grow corn, beans, and squash in fields near river terraces. Women plant and tend these crops, while men travel farther to hunt or trade. The villages remain seasonal, rather than fixed in the European sense. Yet the rhythm of the year includes planting, weeding, and harvest along familiar stretches of riverbank.
The forests and wetlands around what later becomes West Concord bear the marks of that long use. Controlled burning clears underbrush and keeps certain areas open for game and crops. People harvest firewood and cut timber for canoes and frameworks. Occasionally, they allow escaped fires to run through dry leaf litter. These practices create the open pine oak woods that early English travelers describe with surprise. To them, the landscape looks like a kind of natural parkland. To the indigenous communities who shape it, it is a worked environment, managed so that game trails remain accessible and nuts and berries are easy to gather.
Beaver are among the most important ecological partners in this system. Their dams hold back brooks into a chain of ponds and marshes, especially alongside channels like Neshoba Brook. Those ponds host waterfowl, muskrat, and fish. They also store water across seasons, slowing spring floods and keeping wetlands hydrated through dry spells. The combination of human fire and beaver engineering makes Musketaquid unusually rich in edge habitats, where forest meets water and meadow. The English who arrive in the 1630s step into this world at a moment of weakness and opportunity. Epidemics brought by earlier contact have already broken many indigenous communities. Surviving Massachusetts and Nipmuc families continue to claim Musketaquid, but their numbers are sharply reduced. English colonial leaders look inland from the Tidewater settlements. They see a well-watered interior with fewer people to resist them. In 1635, Concord becomes the first official inland town in the Massachusetts Bay Colony above Tidewater. Town records describe about a dozen English families organizing the new settlement. They are guided by men such as Simon Willard and the minister Peter Bulkley. The choice of location reflects both piety and pragmatism. The rivers promise hay from the meadows and power for future mills. The open woods make clearing fields easier. Pre-existing native fields and trails hint at reliable soils and routes. From the beginning, there is a distinction between the new town center and its hinterland. The meeting house, burial ground, and initial house lots cluster on higher land to the east, closer to the junction of the Concord and Sudbury rivers. The broad, wetter lowlands to the west, with the Assabet and its brooks, remain in common use for pasture, woodcutting, and hunting. In those western commons lie the future sites of West Concord. At first, however, they are approached mainly as resource banks for people whose lives are organized around the center. The pattern begins to shift as soon as colonists start to bend flowing water to their purposes. Within less than a decade of the town's founding, they are building mills on the streams that drop enough to turn a wheel. In 1644, George Hayward establishes a sawmill at what becomes known as Hayward's Pond. He uses a dam on one of the Assabet's feeders. For a small farming community, a sawmill is no minor convenience. It turns laborious handwork with an axe and pit saw into a far more efficient process. Local accounts emphasize how quickly surrounding farmers bring logs for cutting, paying in kind or coin. Each mill concentrates activity and people around it. A dam raises the water level upstream, widening the brook into a mill pond. A tail race carries water away below. Travelers bringing grain or logs need a cleared track to reach the mill. Soon, a small cluster of sheds and simple houses clings to the edge of the dam or pond. The land that town meeting still describes as common pasture now also hosts a growing number of specialized workplaces. By 1658, the industrial ambitions of this small town stretch beyond sawing boards and grinding grain. That year, a group of investors establishes the Concord Iron Works near the future Damon Mill site, close to a favorable bend in the Assabet River. They aim to exploit bog iron. This is a mineral deposit that forms in iron-rich wetlands and can be dug up in chunks from the muck. Workers harvest this ore from local swamps and ponds, hauling it to the ironworks to be smelted and forged. The ironworks requires more than a single dam. It demands charcoal for fuel, cut from surrounding woods. It needs steady water power for bellows and hammers. The operation pulls men into waged labor and begins a small but important shift away from an economy based only on family farms. Within a few decades, additional operations cluster along nearby streams.
Around 1700, the Loring Lead Works appears on Neshoba Brook, adding another heavy industry to the mix. Fulling mills also rise on Neshoba Brook and its branches, including one operated by members of the Conant family. These mills use water power to drive hammers that clean and thicken woven cloth. Each of these enterprises uses moving water as its core energy source. The environmental transformation that follows is gradual but relentless. Where the indigenous landscape features a mosaic of beaver ponds and managed woods, the colonial version favors dams built for mills, not for lodges. Trappers pursue beaver for their pelts. This trade is so profitable that, according to early colonial accounts, as many as 10,000 skins a year leave the wider Concord region in the first decades of English control. As beaver numbers fall and then disappear, their abandoned dams breach and drain.
This erases ponds that have existed for centuries. At the same time, settlers cut large swaths of timber for houses, barns, fences, and charcoal pits. They clear new fields in the uplands for English grains and grasses. Cattle and sheep graze the commons, nibbling back saplings before they can become trees. The western part of Concord shifts from a mix of wet meadows and open pine oak forest toward a patchwork of stumped pastures. Cropped fields dominate the open ground, while denser regrowth fills the less accessible corners. Damming the brooks turns out to be one of the most consequential changes. There is no single wall across the Assabet. Instead, a series of smaller obstructions on its tributaries reshape the flow of water. These dams appear at Hayward's Pond, along Neshoba Brook, and at the ironworks site. Mill ponds flood former marshes. New channels are cut for tail races. Downstream, summer water levels drop where upstream ponds hold more back. Fish runs that once pulse into shallow brooks are pinched or cut off entirely by dam faces. Even as these mills alter the landscape, they begin to anchor a new pattern of people and roads. Rough cart tracks, first blazed to bring logs and grain to the mills, firm up into regular routes. One line runs from the town center westward along what becomes a principal road to the ironworks and the Hayward property. Another bends north and south to connect outlying farms to each other and to the growing clusters of workshops. Over time, those informal tracks settle into the bones of later streets and avenues around West Concord. The early governance of Concord adds a further layer of tension to this evolving geography. For much of the 17th and 18th centuries, the western residents remain politically and fiscally tied to the town center. They pay taxes that support institutions they must travel several miles to use. Town meeting, church services, and legal matters all unfold in the eastern village. Yet, economically, many of these western families are coming to depend less on the center and more on the mills and workshops near their homes. By the early 1700s, the fields and commons around Neshoba Brook and the Assabet hold more than scattered farmsteads. Small clusters of mill housing gather near dams. Blacksmith shops, cooperages, and other craft buildings take advantage of both water power and passing traffic. The shift from a purely agrarian landscape toward one that mixes farming with small-scale industry is underway. It is uneven, and the center of town remains dominant, but a separate way of making a living is taking root in the West. Within this framework, the area that future maps label West Concord is still a scattering of named properties rather than a village. Among the significant early landholders is the Harrington family. Their estate stretches across key ground near Neshoba Brook and the future rail yards. Their lands bridge wet meadow and upland, controlling crossings of brooks and the best sites for future roads. In the 17th and 18th centuries, their significance lies mainly in local influence and the ability to lease or sell parcels. Later, those holdings will shape how streets and subdivisions unfold. A new phase begins in the early 19th century, when textile manufacturing arrives on the Assabet in a more modern form. In 1808, Ephraim Hartwell and John Brown build the first textile mill at the old ironworks site. They harness the river to spin and weave cotton. This is not simply another grist mill or sawmill. It is part of a regional surge in mechanized cloth production that transforms several New England rivers into sequences of mill villages. The Hartwell and Brown mill is modest by later standards, but it establishes crucial habits. It runs year-round when water levels permit. It employs workers on regular wages, and it draws in raw cotton from far beyond Concord's borders. Over time, the mill passes through several owners and improvements. The building, initially of wood, sits beside an improved dam and a carefully cut raceway that channels water over the wheel. Farm boys and girls, and an increasing number of specialized mechanics, spend their days under its roof rather than in the fields. In 1834, the property changes hands in a way that fixes its name in local memory. That year, Calvin Carver Damon, an experienced textile man, purchases the mill. Under his leadership, the operation shifts from an ordinary cotton mill into a more innovative enterprise. Town histories describe Damon as technically astute and attentive to market gaps. He strengthens the dam and improves the tail race so that spent water leaves the wheel efficiently. He also installs a more capable water wheel and machinery. Damon's most important contribution is not mechanical, but material. At some point in the 1830s, he develops a new cloth. It is a blend of cotton and wool that produces a light yet warm flannel. This fabric, known as Demet, combines the ease and low cost of cotton with the insulating qualities of wool. It proves especially useful for underwear and other garments worn close to the skin. As orders accumulate, Demet cloth becomes the mill's signature product. It secures a small but notable entry in the wider story of American textiles. By the 1870s, after further expansions and reorganizations under the Damon family, the mill complex employs roughly 175 workers. For a town the size of Concord, that number is significant. It means that dozens of households depend on a single set of buildings along the Assabet for their livelihood. Company and independent housing spreads up nearby roads. A store, perhaps a small school, and other services appear to serve this cluster. The area begins to acquire names of its own: Factory Village, Damondale, and eventually, Westvale. These names mark a psychological as much as a physical shift. People talk about going down to the factory or over to Westvale as if it is distinct from Concord proper. In practical terms, it is. A worker living within a short walk of the mill may have little regular contact with the green and the meeting house in the original center. Wages earned at the looms and carding machines are spent in local shops or carried to boarding house keepers. This money reinforces a small but self-conscious economic loop in the West. The immediate landscape reflects this industrial focus. The Assabet above the mill widens into a controlled pond, its banks lined with stone and timbers. Wastewater flows back into the river, carrying dyes and wool grease downstream. Piles of coal and later wood, barrels of oil, and bales of fiber share yard space with wagons and eventually freight platforms. Neshoba Brook, only a short distance away, continues to power smaller mills and workshops. Second Division Brook, although less heavily developed, helps define the marginal lands. Here, wet soils discourage building. Instead, they invite pastures, recreation, and, in the 20th century, conservation. Amid this intensifying water-powered economy, ownership patterns still matter. The Harrington Estate extends across what will become key streets like Harrington Avenue. It shapes the grid of access to and from the mills. When parcels are sold or leased, they determine where worker housing can cluster and where future rights of way can cut through. In this period, the Harrington lands remain primarily agricultural and semi-rural. Yet, they hold the latent plan of streets that have not yet been drawn. By the mid-19th century, the core dynamic of the region is clear. Geography, especially the relationship between the Assabet River, its brooks, and the rising mills, has begun to pull Concord's center of gravity westward. This pull is economic, even as political and cultural life still orbit the original town center. The West is no longer only commons and woodlots. It is a working industrial village.
It has a growing workforce, distinctive products, and habits of daily life that differ from those in the older, more genteel streets toward the east. What it lacks, so far, is the technology that eventually cements its identity and gives it that lasting nickname, the Junction. The mills along the Assabet still depend on falling water and cart roads. They are vulnerable to drought and slow in their reach to distant markets. Steam power and railroads are about to arrive. When they do, they will transform Factory Village and the surrounding farms into a bustling hub. Tracks, sidings, and institutions will soon reshape the entire western side of Concord. Mid-19th century Massachusetts town reports and railroad company records describe a landscape on the verge of change. The mills along the Assabet River still depend on water falling over dams and on wagons grinding along muddy roads. That balance shifts sharply when iron rails reach the western side of Concord. On June 17, 1844, the Fitchburg Railroad opens through town. It is part of a new east-west line linking Boston to the interior of Massachusetts and the Connecticut River Valley. Company records from that summer describe a small station built near the Damon Mill, on the western edge of what will become West Concord. Trains now carry passengers and freight directly to Boston without the delays of wagon or canal boat. For the mill owners along the Assabet, that change is profound. Bales of cotton, barrels of oil, and crates of finished cloth move with new speed. Farm families along the route can ride into Boston markets in a single day and be back the same evening. Siting the first station near the Damon Mill tilts local trade away from the old road system. Teamsters who once haul cloth by wagon now load it onto rail cars. The map of everyday travel begins to pivot. Where carts and sleighs used to dominate, the timetable of the Fitchburg line starts to set the rhythm. The mill pond, the raceway, and the new platform stand together as a small industrial stage, with the Assabet on one side and the tracks on the other. The new connection also exposes the fragility of this growing industrial village. On June 19, 1862, fire sweeps through the wooden Damon Mill complex. Accounts from that year describe a total loss. Flames take not only the main mill building, but also much of the associated machinery and storage, leaving a tangle of charred timbers beside the river. The timing is cruel. The mill has just finished an order of roughly 50,000 yards of cloth for the United States Army, part of the Civil War demand for uniforms and warm undergarments. In a single day, the physical plant that makes that work possible disappears. The response from the family that owns the mill is immediate and decisive. Edward Carver Damon, the son of founder Calvin Damon, has already stepped into leadership of the business by the mid-1850s. In the wake of the fire, he chooses not to retreat but to rebuild at once. He turns to Elbridge Boyden, an accomplished architect based in Worcester, who is already known for substantial brick and stone industrial buildings. Instead of recreating the vulnerable wooden complex, Damon and Boyden design an entirely new mill in brick, meant to be both more fire-resistant and more imposing. The building that rises over the next months marks an architectural and psychological shift. Completed later in 1862, the new structure presents an Italianate profile to both river and rails. Tall, regularly spaced windows admit light to the weaving and carding floors. Brick walls with decorative corbelling and bracketed eaves lift the mill above the level of a simple shed. A tablet on the riverside bears the name Damondale, a blend of Damon and Eben Dale, the firm's selling agent. More than a factory, it is an emblem. Passing train passengers see a modern brick landmark rather than a weathered wooden box. Local residents begin to treat the mill not only as a workplace, but also as a symbol of the West Side's permanence and ambition. As the mill regains and then expands its output in the 1860s, the rail network that serves it grows more intricate. The Fitchburg line still runs east-west along the Assabet, but railroad promoters are already planning a north-south route that will cross it somewhere near Neshoba Brook. Their goal is to connect the manufacturing town of Lowell with the rail hub at Framingham, threading through a series of rural communities along the way.
In 1870, the Framingham and Lowell Railroad is incorporated to build this line. Construction crews lay track through Sudbury and into Concord's western meadows. On October 1, 1871, trains begin running over the roughly 26-mile route, where the new north-south line meets the older Fitchburg tracks in a low-lying part of Concord known as Warnerville, a physical junction comes into being. Two railroads now cross at grade in what has been open fields and scattered farm buildings. Railroad timetables and maps from the early 1870s show how quickly that crossing turns into a focal point. The original station by Damon Mill gives way to a new passenger depot sited precisely at the junction of the lines. A freight house rises nearby to handle carloads of goods transferred between east-west and north-south trains. An engine house and a turntable follow, allowing locomotives to be serviced and turned. Sidings branch out like fingers, offering space to assemble trains, load lumber or barrels, and hold cars waiting for a connection. In a few short years, Warnerville evolves from a quiet stretch of meadow into a busy rail yard. The arrival of a third railroad cements that change. In 1873, the Nashua, Acton, and Boston Railroad gains access to Concord by securing running rights over part of the new north-south line. Its trains, coming from New Hampshire, begin to call at the growing junction. Schedules are arranged so that passengers can step off one company's train and onto another, heading east to Boston, south to Framingham, or north toward Nashua with only a short wait on the platform. By the 1890s, railroad records count roughly 120 to 125 trains a day passing through what is now regularly called Concord Junction. That figure includes through trains, locals, and freight movements. It represents a volume of traffic that makes the junction busier than Concord's original center. Station agents, yardmasters, telegraph operators, and section crews keep the complex system moving. For people in the village, the hiss of steam, the clang of couplers, and the shrill call of whistles become constant features of daily life. Industry moves quickly to take advantage of this new accessibility. The Warner Pail and Tub Factory, which has its roots in mid-19th century woodworking along Neshoba Brook, expands production of wooden pails, tubs, and similar containers. Bulky in proportion to their value, these goods once travel slowly by wagon. With rail sidings at hand, carloads of pails can be shipped efficiently to city wholesalers. Nearby, a chemical producer known locally as the Blue Wine Company manufactures a bluing agent used to whiten laundry, relying on both rail delivery of raw materials and rail shipment of finished product. Along the tracks, the Allen Chair Company builds a multi-story factory to turn out wooden chairs at a scale matched to the new transportation system. Each of these enterprises draws on the same advantages. They use relatively cheap in-town sites near the junction, a labor pool that can walk to work, and the ability to ship products over several competing rail lines. As these new shops and factories go up, the settlement pattern on Concord's west side becomes more complex. Three distinct centers of activity start to emerge, each with its own character. Up the Assabet, around the Damon Mill and its pond, stands Westvale, often still called Factory Village or Damondale. There, the brick Italianate mill and its support buildings dominate the view, and many of the houses belong to people who work directly with cloth. Down by the tracks where the rail lines cross and the Warner Pail and Tub Factory hums beside Neshoba Brook lies Warnerville, increasingly referred to simply as the Junction. Here, freight cars, sheds, and small stores cluster around the station. To the south, on higher, sandier ground, a new institutional landscape is beginning to take shape. This area soon gives rise to the third local name, Prison Village. The origins of that third center lie in statewide debates about punishment and reform. By the late 1870s, Massachusetts officials are searching for a site for a new state reformatory for men, separate from existing prisons. They intend it to be a place where younger offenders can be trained, disciplined, and, in theory, return to society reformed. In 1878, the Commonwealth begins building what is first called the Massachusetts State Reformatory on farmland in the southwestern part of Concord's west side. Several factors make this location attractive to state planners. The newly powerful rail network means that both construction materials and, later, prisoners and supplies can move in and out efficiently. The junction lies close enough that rail spurs and wagon roads can carry bricks, stone, timber, and iron bars straight from the cars to the building site. Yet the proposed complex is far enough from Concord's traditional center that its imposing presence does not overshadow the town green or the 18th century streets. Land cost also plays a role. Much of the ground chosen for the reformatory is sandy and not especially valuable for intensive farming. Owners willing to sell large tracts find the state to be a ready buyer. The area offers access to water as well. Wells and small streams can supply the institution, while the broader Assabet Basin provides a landscape for prison farms that grow food for inmates and staff. Construction begins with foundations and long brick walls that rise in stages. Contemporary descriptions emphasize the scale of the place compared with anything nearby. Cell blocks and administrative buildings mass behind tall perimeter walls. Outside the masonry, cleared fields and farm outbuildings spread toward the tree line. From the moment the first sections of wall stand complete, the reformatory marks a hard new edge in the landscape. Where fields and woods once meet in a soft transition, there is now a stark line between inside and outside. The social impact of this decision reaches beyond the prison itself. The building phase draws laborers from other towns and from abroad, including men used to large masonry projects. When the institution opens, it requires a permanent staff of corrections officers, clerks, cooks, maintenance workers, and medical personnel. Many of those jobs are appealing in a small town context. They offer steady state pay, predictable hours compared with seasonal fieldwork or mill shifts, and a measure of status. Over the following decades, the reformatory and its successor institutions provide hundreds of paychecks every month.
That public payroll helps support stores, boarding houses, and professional services throughout the West Side. Housing patterns shift in response. A belt of residences suitable for guards and other staff begins to form within walking distance of the prison gates. This is the nucleus of what local people call Prison Village, or, more formally, the Reformatory neighborhood. Its residents share daily routines shaped by the beat of keys and the tolling of institutional bells, rather than by the factory whistle or the church clock. Children grow up with the hulking walls on the horizon and fenced prison farms as their near neighbors. Those walls and fields, in turn, become one of the most defining visual boundaries of the village. Approaching from almost any direction, a walker or rider can gauge position by the moment the prison buildings come into view or slip behind trees. The open acres of the prison farm, planted to corn or lying in pasture, red as a broad green foreground to the crenellated silhouettes of the walls. For people crossing the West Side, the Reformatory complex serves as a landmark as unmistakable as the Damon Mill Tower or the station roofs. The appearance of this great institutional neighbor also accelerates a quieter but crucial process, the subdivision of long-held private estates. Among the most important of these is the Harrington family property, which extends across key ground between Neshoba Brook, the future junction yards, and the land now devoted to the reformatory. Earlier, that estate functions mainly as farmland and pasture. As pressure for housing rises in the late 19th century, the Harringtons begin to sell and divide portions of their land to accommodate new streets and house lots. Out of that process comes Harrington Avenue, a new corridor cut across former fields. It links the industrial and railroad districts more directly to the institutional south and to the older roads running east toward Concord Center. Platted in relatively narrow lots with enough depth for modest houses and gardens, the avenue quickly fills with dwellings for mill workers, section hands, shopkeepers, and prison employees. In essence, it is a residential spine binding together the three emerging villages of Westvale, Warnerville, and Prison Village.
The houses along Harrington Avenue mirror the class distinctions in the local economy. On corner lots near the main roads and closer to the junction, larger, more ornamented homes rise. These feature bay windows, front porches, or decorative trim that hints at supervisory or professional incomes. Set back a little from these are more modest two-story or one-and-a-half-story dwellings. Built on tighter lots with simpler finishes, they are home to machine tenders, laborers, and junior guards. The differences are visible in roof lines, yard sizes, and the depth of decorative detail. For anyone walking the length of the avenue, the gradation from more prosperous facades to plainer cottages makes the social hierarchy of the West Side legible in wood and paint. Threading behind many of these properties runs Second Division Brook, the small watercourse introduced earlier as a minor player in the town's hydrology. As the 19th century closes, this modest brook finds itself increasingly hemmed in. To the north and east, yards, sheds, and factory outbuildings press toward its banks. To the south and west, the prison farm and its ancillary roads approach the water. In places, the brook runs through a narrow ribbon of trees, a thin green margin left between back fences and institutional land. It is no grand river, but it becomes a quiet buffer and a hidden boundary between different uses and social worlds. Along one stretch of this corridor, a group of local residents organize what becomes known as the Muscataquid Sportsman Club. The exact founding date falls around the turn of the 20th century, when organized sportsmen's associations are gaining popularity across New England. The founders choose a name that echoes the older indigenous term for the region, and they secure land along the brook for a small clubhouse, shooting grounds, and access to fishing spots. Members come to practice marksmanship, fish in the brook and nearby ponds, and hold seasonal gatherings. The club's activities leave their own mark on the landscape. To create safe shooting lanes, members clear and grade parts of the banks. To improve fishing, they sometimes work with state or local officials to stock trout or to press for cleaner water upstream. In an era when industrial waste and household refuse often find their way into small streams, this attention helps keep at least a portion of Second Division Brook in relatively good condition. The club thus functions, in a modest way, as an early force for conservation in the neighborhood. Its presence also adds another layer to the already intricate relationship between the brook, the prison, and nearby homes. On some days, the sound of gunfire from trap shooting practice drifts across to the prison grounds or over backyards, a reminder that recreation and incarceration sit side by side. Neighbors sometimes welcome the open space and the sense of watchful occupancy the club provides. On other occasions, they may resent noise or stray shot. Prison authorities, for their part, have to consider both security and public relations, balancing the desire for community ties with the need to prevent any misuse of the area along the walls. Over time, a kind of uneasy symbiosis develops. The club's members help watch the Brook Corridor and discourage dumping or trespass, while the existence of state-controlled land nearby limits how far residential encroachment can proceed. Back up river, at Westvale, the Damon Enterprise is undergoing its own transformation. The rebuilt brick mill has enjoyed years of success producing Domet flannel and related fabrics. Yet by the 1880s, shifts in fashion, competition from larger textile centers, and changes in technology begin to squeeze the business. Records from this period show that Edward Damon and his son reorganize the operation as the Damon Manufacturing Company and seek ways to modernize. One of the most significant changes is in the mill's source of power. For decades, the flow of the Assabet, regulated by dam and raceway, has driven the machinery. In dry summers or harsh winters, that reliance proves risky. Water levels can fall too low, or ice can interfere with wheels and turbines. To keep looms running more consistently and at higher speeds, the company invests in coal-fired steam power. A substantial rear addition rises behind the main brick block, housing two large boilers and associated equipment. A tall brick chimney, visible for a long distance up and down the river, vents the smoke from burning coal brought in by rail.
This shift from water to steam marks a turning point not only for the Damon Mill, but also for the West Side as a whole. It represents a definitive move toward energy sources that are no longer tied directly to local rivers and brooks. The mills now draw their power from fuel mined hundreds of miles away and delivered over the very tracks that converge at Concord Junction. The air smells of coal smoke as well as of wet wool and dye. Cinders drift down on nearby roofs. The river still matters. It provides process water for washing and dyeing, and it carries away waste, but it no longer solely governs the pace of production. By the last decade of the 19th century, all these threads have woven together into a dense fabric of industrial, residential, and institutional life. Westvale's brick mill and worker housing, Warnerville's busy rail yards and factories, and Prison Village's walls and staff dwellings are no longer separate outposts. They blend into a single, bustling community that many residents and travelers now know simply as Concord Junction. Tracks and timetables, smokestacks and watchtowers, front porches and clubhouses all share the same small basin of the Assabet. The new century brings changes in transportation, industry, and penal policy. Those shifts test the resilience of this junction-built village and push its mills, rail lines, and institutions into unfamiliar roles. In the early years of the 20th century, the west side of Concord stands at its peak as an industrial and institutional engine. Railroad records from the 1910s count dozens of trains a day passing through the junction. Between them, the Damon Mill and the Allen Chair Company employ hundreds of workers. Nearby, the state reformatory's payroll reaches steadily into households along Harrington Avenue and Prison Village. For the first time since the founding of Concord in the 1630s, more of the town's daily economic life unfolds amid smokestacks, sidings, and prison walls than around the green and the meeting house in the original center. This concentration of work changes habits and loyalties. Shop fronts cluster near the station, along Main Street and Commonwealth Avenue. They serve a clientele whose shift times revolve around train schedules and factory whistles. Grocers, barbers, and boarding house keepers depend on pay packets earned at the looms, in the chair factory, or inside the prison. By 1910, local accounts describe West Concord, then still widely called Concord Junction, as the town's busiest district. The older center becomes more of an administrative and cultural capital than a commercial one. Yet the very industries that make the junction prosperous begin to stumble as the new century advances. For textiles in particular, the years after the First World War prove punishing. The Damon Mill has already shifted from water to steam and from Domet flannel to dress goods.
Now, it faces Southern competition and changing fashions it cannot match. In the early 1920s, textile production at the site effectively ceases. The handsome brick building that once hummed with carding machines and looms becomes an asset in search of a purpose. Its great rooms are rented out for storage or light manufacturing rather than continuous textile work. Even as the mill's economic role contracts, the village's identity sharpens in the 1920s around a different question. The issue is what to call the place. For decades, railroad timetables, business advertisements, and residents themselves have used the name Concord Junction. At the same time, postal officials and some town leaders favor West Concord. This simpler label ties the village more clearly to the parent town. By 1928, the tension between these names comes to a head. Postal records from 1928 describe persistent confusion between mail addressed to Concord and to Concord Junction. Letters and parcels regularly end up at the wrong post office. Residents complain that shipments go astray or arrive late. Federal postal administrators press for a single, unambiguous name that distinguishes the West Side office from the one near the Green. In town meeting debates and petitions sent to Boston and Washington, some residents argue that Concord Junction captures the village's true character as a crossroads of lines and livelihoods. Others counter that West Concord signals civic parity with the older center and avoids the sense of being merely a railroad appendage. In the end, officialdom prevails.
In 1928, the federal government recognizes West Concord as the proper postal name. The town follows suit on maps and road signs. Concord Junction survives as the title of the railroad station for a time, then gradually recedes from formal use. It does not vanish from memory, however. Long afterward, people who grew up in the era of steam and sidings continue to talk about going down to the junction. They use the old name as a kind of verbal keepsake for the period when trains, not traffic lights, ruled the village. Those trains are already facing a new rival. From the 1920s through the mid-20th century, state highway maps show the automobile reshaping travel patterns across eastern Massachusetts. The state upgrades and straightens an east-west roadway across Concord that it designates as Route 2. Over several decades, that road evolves from a local highway into a multi-lane arterial carrying commuters between the growing suburbs and Boston. On the map, Route 2 runs roughly parallel to the Fitchburg Line. On the ground, it steals the railroad's monopoly on speed. As car ownership spreads in the 1930s and 40s, fewer people board local trains for short trips between Concord, Acton, and points beyond. Businesses that once relied on rail freight begin shifting to trucks. These vehicles can move goods directly from factory door to customer without the constraints of timetables or yard fees. Railroad companies, facing rising costs and falling revenues, respond by trimming service. Mixed trains that once stopped at every small station are consolidated or canceled. By the 1950s, passenger schedules at West Concord list only a fraction of the daily trains that ran in the 1890s. The physical plant shrinks in parallel. The roundhouse, turntable, and engine facilities that once stood just south of the main line become surplus. As diesels replace steam and through freights run longer distances without stopping, there is less need to turn locomotives or host a resident engine crew. In the mid-20th century, railroad crews dismantle the roundhouse and fill in sidings. The wide fan of tracks that once spread across the meadows narrows to a handful of through lines and a few industrial spurs. Where loops and ladders of steel once lay, there are now parking lots, storage yards, and, in time, new buildings. Industrial decline deepens this contraction. The Allen Chair Complex and other wood products factories along Neshoba Brook lose ground to larger, more modern plants in other regions. They also struggle against changing tastes in office and household furniture. Some operations limp along into the 1950s and 60s, while others close sooner. The Warner Pale Works passes through different owners and eventually ceases large-scale production. By the 1970s, town reports and photographs show a sobering scene. The great brick block of the Damon Mill serves mainly as cold storage for apples. Its windows are boarded or clouded, and its once busy loading docks host only a trickle of trucks. The frame buildings of former chair and pail factories stand partly vacant or underused. Their paint peels,
and their yards are cluttered with derelict machinery. For West Concord as an industrial landscape, these years mark a nadir. The village that once prided itself on being a place of work and movement seems at risk of becoming a backwater of half-empty sheds and obsolete tracks. At the same time, forces of suburbanization are pressing in from all sides. After the Second World War, a regional housing boom sends waves of single-family construction through the open fields. These fields once separated the distinct hamlets of Westvale, Warnerville, and Prison Village. Zoning maps drawn in the 1950s and 60s assign large areas of the west side to residential use. These zones often mandate minimum lot sizes that favor ranch houses, capes, and split levels. By around 1970, the gaps between the old clusters have largely filled. What were once three distinct villages now read on the ground as one continuous suburban fabric, threaded by familiar older streets. The prison on the south side of this fabric undergoes a quieter but equally important transformation. The Massachusetts State Reformatory was founded in the 1870s with an explicit mission of rehabilitation for younger men. In the mid-20th century, it gradually sheds that identity.
Department of Correction reports indicate a shift toward a more standardized network of institutions. Consequently, the Concord facility is redesignated as the Massachusetts Correctional Institution at Concord, commonly called MCI Concord. Its formal status changes from a specialized reformatory to a medium security prison for adult men. This administrative shift brings physical and social changes. In the 1950s and 60s, the state raises new perimeter walls and fences. It installs more elaborate security hardware and replaces some older farm-related outbuildings with modern service structures. The extensive prison farm acreage that once stretched along 2nd Division Brook and beyond is reduced or reconfigured as agricultural work programs shrink. Fewer men go out daily to work the fields under guard. Instead, more time is spent within the walls and in workshops inside the secure perimeter. For the town, the institution remains a major employer. State payrolls in the later 20th century still list hundreds of staff positions at MCI Concord, from correctional officers and counselors to maintenance workers and nurses. Many of those employees live in West Concord and nearby towns. They anchor a local middle class that relies on steady public sector income. Yet the psychological distance between the prison and the community grows. High walls, razor wire, and a greater emphasis on security harden the boundary. Earlier generations of residents recall seeing men in prison uniforms working in fields along local roads. Later generations, however, encounter the institution mainly as a set of forbidding walls glimpsed while driving past. As the factory buildings age and the prison turns inward, a new response begins to stir among local property owners, planners, and preservationists. Instead of seeing the old industrial complexes as expendable, some begin to treat them as assets. In the 1970s, a period otherwise marked by disinvestment, a handful of projects test a new idea. They propose that 19th-century mills can find new lives in a post-industrial economy. The Damon Mill becomes a touchstone for this adaptive reuse movement. After roughly half a century as a cold storage facility, the building is in rough condition by the early 1970s. Its brickwork needs repair, its interiors lack modern utilities, and its surroundings are cluttered. Yet, its Italianate proportions and riverside setting catch the imagination of developers and members of the Damon family who still live in the region. Working with architects and contractors familiar with historic structures, they strip out obsolete machinery and insulation. They stabilize the masonry and carve the interior into offices and studios, respecting the rhythm of the original windows and beams. By 1980, the restored complex is complete enough to earn a listing on the National Register of Historic Places under the name Damon Mill Square. The federal listing, managed by the National Park Service, recognizes the building's significance as an example of 19th century industrial architecture. It also honors the site as a representative of New England's textile heritage. This designation signals to the town and to potential tenants that the old mill is not a relic, but a viable place for contemporary work. Over the following decades, design firms, professional practices, and small businesses occupy its rooms. The mill pond outside, once a reservoir of power for water wheels and turbines, becomes a scenic backdrop for office workers and visitors. Similar, if smaller scale, efforts touch other industrial buildings.
The former Allen Chair Company structures along Neshoba Brook avoid the wholesale demolition that erases so many early 20th century factories in other towns. Portions are renovated for light manufacturing, warehousing, and later, creative and technical enterprises. Their long facades and large windows continue to define the streetscape near the brook. They provide a physical memory of the days when rail spurs edged their foundations and chair parts moved in and out by the carload. The survival of these and other factory buildings allows West Concord to retain a legible industrial core, even as their uses shift from production to services and crafts. While real estate and planning professionals are rediscovering the value of brick and timber, a parallel rediscovery unfolds along the watercourses that first made those structures possible.
By the 1970s, pollution of New England rivers and brooks has become a subject of public concern. The Federal Clean Water Act of 1972 gives new tools and funding streams to address sewage and industrial discharges. In the Assabet and the Neshoba watersheds, local activists and town officials work with state agencies. Together, they upgrade wastewater treatment plants, regulate industrial effluents, and monitor water quality. Over the last decades of the 20th century, their reports show gradual improvements in oxygen levels and reductions in certain pollutants. On the ground in West Concord, these broader environmental currents translate into specific land use decisions. Town meeting records show authorizations for purchases of riverfront parcels for conservation and recreation. By the 1980s and 90s, the town has assembled a patchwork of protected land along the Assabet and Neshoba Brook corridors, sometimes in partnership with regional land trusts. Trails thread these greenways. They give residents access to river views that, a century earlier, were largely the province of mill workers and railroad hands. In the early 21st century, a disused segment of the old Framingham and Lowell rail line is converted into a paved multi-use path. This project further knits together the idea of mobility, recreation, and environmental repair along the former industrial spine. Second Division Brook, the modest stream that once served as an informal drain and backlot boundary, also experiences a shift in status. For much of the 20th century, it carried runoff from yards, small workshops, and portions of the prison property, winding through culverts and narrow strips of scrub. Local conservation commissions and state environmental agencies begin to pay closer attention to such headwater and side channels in the later 20th century. Surveys and planning documents note the brook's role as a wildlife corridor and as a link between larger wetland systems. In response, development rules tighten around its banks. Setback requirements, stormwater regulations, and selective land acquisitions work together to protect at least some of its length from further encroachment. Portions that were once treated almost as ditches gain informal footpaths and pockets of riparian vegetation. Residents come to recognize the brook not only as a line on a survey map, but as a narrow, living thread that connects backyards to broader ecological systems. The Musketaquid Sportsman Club, long established along one reach of Second Division Brook, finds itself increasingly at the center of the tension between inherited uses and a suburbanizing landscape. When the club was founded around the turn of the 20th century, its shooting grounds and fishing access sat on the fringe of settled areas. Nearby were open farm fields, prison acreage, and relatively few houses. By the late 20th century, that context has changed. Houses press closer from multiple directions. Zoning board minutes describe neighbor concerns about the noise of gunfire, the safety of shotfall, and the compatibility of a shooting range with family backyards. Club members, for their part, point to their long tenure, their attention to range safety, and their role in maintaining open space along the brook. Zoning boards and local officials are drawn into periodic efforts to balance these interests. Conditions on permits, adjustments to range layouts, and limits on shooting hours represent attempts to reconcile tradition with changing expectations. Through it all, the club persists. It remains a reminder that the cultural landscape of West Concord includes not only literary pilgrimages and cafe culture, but also long-standing sporting practices rooted in the region's rivers and woods. As the physical environment of West Concord is being reconsidered, its social composition is changing as well. In the early and mid-20th century, the West Side has a reputation as the more blue-collar part of town. It holds concentrations of mill families, prison employees, and small tradespeople. Houses along Harrington Avenue, Commonwealth Avenue, and side streets near the junction are modest in scale. they were built for workers who walked to local jobs or to the station for short rail commutes. From the 1970s onward, broader patterns of metropolitan growth transformed that profile.
Proximity to Boston, improved highways, and the continued operation of commuter rail service on the Fitchburg Line make Concord attractive to new arrivals. Professionals working in the city and in the burgeoning corridors of Route 128 and Route 495 begin to settle in the area. As demand for housing in historic, well-served towns increases, property values in West Concord rise. Modest mill houses, once within reach of working-class buyers, appreciate steadily. By the closing years of the 20th century, real estate listings and assessment data show that simple cottages built for loom tenders and section hands command prices that would have been unthinkable a generation earlier. This process brings new resources and attention to the village. Restaurants, small galleries, and specialty shops find enough customers to thrive alongside more traditional hardware stores and service businesses. At the same time, it raises concerns about displacement and access. Long-time renters face higher costs. Younger people who grew up in the neighborhood find it harder to buy in. Planning documents and community forums begin to reflect tensions over gentrification. Residents wrestle with how to welcome investment without losing the social diversity that once characterized the junction. Planning debates reflect these tensions. In the early 21st century, Concord commissioned several studies focused specifically on West Concord. These include village plans that address building scale, traffic, and land use. Public meetings draw residents who argue for preserving the village character of the commercial core, its two- and three-story buildings, walkable streets, and mix of uses. Others emphasize the need for more housing, especially smaller units near transit, to keep the community accessible to a wider range of incomes and ages. Proposals for new development on underused parcels near the station, the river, or the prison edge prompt detailed conversations. Topics include height limits, architectural design, parking, and open space. Through all of this, questions of identity keep surfacing. Concord as a whole is internationally known for its literary heritage and its role in the opening of the American Revolution. Tour groups and school buses focus on the Old North Bridge, the homes of Emerson and Alcott, and the landscape of Walden Pond. Yet many who live in town spend much of their daily time in West Concord. They catch a train from the station platform, grab coffee near the tracks, walk a dog along the Assabet, or attend a meeting in a repurposed mill. Some residents describe themselves first as people of West Concord, distinguishing their neighborhood from the more museum-like feel of the historic center. The names themselves carry different resonances. The word Concord evokes Concord Bridge, transcendentalism, and carefully preserved 18th-century streets. West Concord calls up images of a working village, remade but not erased, a place of shops, studios, and sidings. For older generations, the junction remains an affectionate shorthand that holds together all three eras: the mill village, the railroad crossing, and the suburban hub. Looking back across the centuries, a clear causal chain emerges beneath these layers of name and use. The story begins with the rivers and brooks. The Assabet, Neshoba Brook, and Second Division Brook shape the first choices about where to fish, farm, and build mills. Their falls and bends fix the location of water-powered industry in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries. Those mills, in turn, attract roads and workers' houses, giving form to Factory Village along the Assabet and to smaller clusters along Neshoba Brook. Railroads reinforce and amplify that pattern without breaking it. The decision in the 1840s to run the Fitchburg Line along the Assabet, and then in the 1870s to cross it with the Framingham and Lowell Line, locks the Warnerville Meadows into a new role as a junction. Once tracks, depots, and yards are in place, factory owners choose adjoining sites. The Warner Pale Works, the Allen Chair Company, and others line up along the rails and the brook. State officials, seeking a reformatory site with good transport and cheap land, select the sandy uplands to the south, within easy reach of the same rail network. The prison's walls and farms establish a southern anchor as solid as the Damon Mills Tower to the north.
Even as the underlying technologies change, from water wheels to steam, and from steam to diesel and highway, the physical template laid down by river power and rail junctions persists. Suburban subdivisions fill in around, not instead of, the old cores.
Adaptive reuse projects work with existing mill walls rather than sweeping them aside. Conservation efforts trace the same corridors along the Assabet and its brooks that once hosted beaver dams and flumes, then sewer outfalls and sidings. The modern village of West Concord, with its blend of cafes, classrooms, state jobs, and trailheads, occupies a landscape whose bones were set when the first dam went in on a side brook and the first surveyors drove stakes for the Fitchburg line. At the close, the essential elements remain visible to anyone who knows where to look. Trains still cross at West Concord. They are now sleek commuter sets and freights rather than coal-burning locals, but they follow the same alignments first laid in the 1840s and 70s. The high walls and guard towers of MCI Concord still mark the southern horizon. Their institutional presence is a reminder of more than a century of penal policy and public employment. Between and beyond them, the Assabet River and its brooks, including the once overlooked 2nd Division Brook, continue to wind through thickets, under bridges, and past backyards. Understanding that interplay between geography, infrastructure, and human choice allows the village's past and present to be read as a single, coherent narrative, rather than as a series of disconnected scenes. Thank you for choosing myaudiobooks.ai.